I want you to think about the last time you tried to force someone to do something. Like, really picture it in your head.
Oh, man. Yeah. That is usually a painful memory for most people.
Right. I mean, maybe it was a colleague who just kept dragging their feet on a massive project, or a spouse who simply refused to organize the garage.
Or a toddler staging a full-blown sit-in over eating their peas. We have all been there.
Exactly. And you used your authority, right? You raised your voice, you laid out the consequences, and, well, what did you actually gain?
Usually. Nothing but resentment.
Yeah. If you look back on it, it's just exhausting. Even if you eventually, you know, wore them down and they complied, the relationship took a massive hit. You could probably feel the friction in the room.
You absolutely could. And that is because you were operating under this widespread delusion that, well, most of us are taught from day one.
The idea that if you have enough authority, you can simply make people do things.
Right. And today, we are going to basically unlearn that. We are unlearning the biggest lie in leadership.
Yes, we are. Welcome to today's deep dive. We are on a mission to explore what I really think is the ultimate cheat code for human motivation and productivity.
It really is a cheat code. We are leaving the outdated, deeply frustrating world of what we'll call boss management completely behind.
And we're stepping into this concept called lead management. We are going to completely rethink how we interact with the people around us.
And everything we are unpacking today comes directly from a brilliant book by business consultant and psychologist Kenneth L. Pierce.
It's called Using Lead Management on Purpose, right?
Exactly. Pierce takes Dr. William Glasser's choice theory, which is this really profound psychological framework, and he applies it directly to how we manage people.
And what's great is it does not matter if you are sitting in a corporate boardroom running a hospital floor or, you know, just trying to manage your own living room.
Yeah. The mechanics of human motivation, they remain exactly the same across the board.
So the core premise here is that traditional management relies on what Pierce calls external control psychology.
Which is basically the classic carrot and the stick.
Right. We tell people, do this and you get a bonus, or don't do this and you get fired. We treat people like donkeys pulling a cart.
But humans aren't donkeys. I mean, we aren't fundamentally driven by someone else's carrot. We are driven internally.
Which brings up a pretty glaring paradox, I think. If traditional bossing, this external control thing, is so fundamentally flawed and creates so much resentment, why do so many incredibly smart, well-intentioned people still use it every single day?
That is the mystery we need to solve first. And Pierce uses a highly unexpected analogy to explain why leaders accidentally sabotage their own teams.
Yeah, he talks about relying on this so-called common sense bossing. Mm-hmm. And the analogy involves, of all things, Snow White.
It sounds totally absurd at first, but it perfectly maps out the blind spots of traditional management.
Okay, so imagine Snow White. She leaves her royal kingdom. She has watched her father rule for years, so she thinks, you know, she understands leadership.
Right, she has that royal confidence.
Exactly. So she wanders into the forest and stumbles upon this diamond mine run by the seven dwarfs. Now, to her eyes, the mine is doing okay, but she looks at the dwarfs and sees them singing, dancing, taking frequent breaks.
She looks at this through the lens of external control and basically thinks, wow, they lack discipline.
Yeah. So she steps in and declares herself the boss. She reorganizes their entire workflow, gives them strict directives, hovers over their shoulders to point out every tiny flaw.
Total micromanagement.
And completely ignores their input because, in her mind, she is the royalty. She is the manager, so she obviously knows best.
But the outcome is where the real lesson lies. I mean, you would think with all this new structure and oversight, production would just skyrocket.
But it doesn't.
No, it tanks. The dwarf's quality of work plummets. The quantity of diamonds declines. They literally just stop caring.
Because Snow White was operating under three massive illusions of boss management.
Right. First, she thought she knew more about mining than the actual miners who had been doing it for years.
Classic mistake. And second?
Second, she believed she didn't need their input to create a quality product. And third, and this is the most dangerous illusion, she assumed she could force quality out of them through strict direction.
So she managed their physical actions, but she completely ignored who they were as individuals.
Exactly. And that disconnect is mapped out beautifully in a framework Pierce adapts from Robert Diltz called the Hierarchy of Being.
This explains the exact mechanism of why the dwarves checked out.
Yes. Think of the hierarchy of being as five stack levels at which every human operates, especially at work.
Okay, so what's at the bottom?
At the very bottom, the foundational level, you have behaviors. That is what we physically do with our hands and feet. Just above that are strategies, how we think about doing that.
Okay, hands, feet, and basic problem solving.
Right. Moving up, we hit beliefs, what we personally value and hold to be true. Then comes identity, how we fundamentally see ourselves.
Land at the top.
At the very pinnacle is spirit, our sense of purpose, and how we connect to the bigger picture around us.
Okay, wait, I have to stop you there and just playfully push back on this.
Go for it.
If I'm a mid-level manager at a paper company, my job is exactly about behaviors and strategies. I need boxes packed and loaded onto trucks.
Sure, you need the physical output.
Right, so why on earth should I care about my warehouse workers' spirit or their identity? We aren't running a wellness retreat. We are moving inventory.
I hear you. And it is the most common objection in the corporate world. But here is the harsh, unavoidable reality of human capital.
Which is?
You can buy a worker's time. You can buy their physical presence in the warehouse. You can even demand their behaviors and their basic strategies.
Because you're paying them.
Right. But you absolutely cannot buy their creativity, their enthusiasm, or their deep commitment to quality.
Oh, I see.
Those elements do not exist at the bottom of the hierarchy. They exist exclusively at the top in their beliefs, their identity, and their spirit.
So you are saying a worker has to voluntarily choose to give those top three levels to a leader.
Precisely. Boss managers only ever communicate with the bottom two levels. They talk to the hands and the feet.
But lead managers understand that to get true quality, they have to connect the daily work to the top three levels. They have to earn that voluntary commitment.
Exactly. Which means if we cannot force someone's commitment, we have to understand what actually motivates them from the inside out.
We have to move away from how we think they should work and start looking at what they fundamentally want as human beings.
And Pierce explains that all human behavior, without exception, is driven by five basic genetic needs.
These aren't just preferences, right? Like, these are biological imperatives.
Yeah, these are deep psychological drives that our brains are constantly seeking to fulfill.
The book uses a hand metaphor that makes this incredibly sticky for the listener.
Mm-hmm.
I love this part.
It's a great visual.
Yeah, so hold up your hand for a second. Your thumb represents survival. That is your need for food, shelter, safety, and yes, a basic paycheck.
The foundation.
Right. Then your pointer finger, the one that points the way, is freedom. That is your deep psychological need for choice and autonomy.
Which boss managers usually crush.
Completely. Then your middle finger, standing the tallest, is power. Now, in this context, power doesn't mean dominating others. It means recognition, achievement, and self-respect.
Feeling capable.
Exactly.
Mm.
Your ring finger is love, so the need for belonging, friendship, and connection with your team. And finally, your pinky finger is fun.
And Pierce defines fun not just as, you know, laughing at a joke, but as the joy of learning, making progress, and solving puzzles.
Right. But most traditional workplaces operate under the assumption that people only care about the thumb.
Survival, the paycheck. Just do the work to get paid.
But those other four fingers are incredibly powerful psychological drivers. I mean, if a workplace micromanages an employee, it crushes their need for freedom.
Or if a boss takes credit for a project, it snarves the employee's need for power and self-respect.
Totally. And over the course of our lives, our brains are constantly scanning the environment to find out who and what satisfies these five needs.
And when we find something that hits the mark, we store it in a very specific, idealized mental photo album. Pierce calls this our quality world.
I picture the quality world like a highly exclusive VIP club located deep inside your brain.
Oh, I like that analogy.
Yeah, it's where you keep the absolute best stuff, the people you trust, the values you cherish, the work you actually care about.
And this changes everything about leadership, because the ultimate goal of a lead manager is to get themselves, the work, and the customer past the velvet rope and into that workers' VIP club.
Because we only ever give our best effort, our highest creativity, and our top-tier problem-solving to the things that have made it inside our quality world.
Exactly.
So let's apply this to the listener. Think about your own VIP club for a second. Who is the bouncer standing outside the velvet rope?
The bouncer is made up of your psychological needs for freedom, power, and respect.
Right. Now imagine a boss manager marching up to the club. They show up with threats, criticism, and a clipboard full of micromanagement.
The bouncer is going to cross their arms, look at that boss, and say, "Absolutely not. You are a threat to our autonomy and our self-respect. You aren't getting in."
And the moment that manager is denied entry to the quality world, the employee physically and mentally checks out.
They will do the bare minimum required to keep their survival paycheck, but they will volunteer absolutely nothing else.
Okay, so once a leader grasps this, once they realize they have to earn their way past the bouncer, how do they actually steer human behavior to get there?
Right, moving from theory to practice.
Yeah, because we know what people want internally, but how does that translate to their outward actions on like a Tuesday morning at the office?
Well, Pierce introduces a concept called total behavior to bridge that exact gap. He explains that every single behavior we engage in has four distinct, inseparable components happening all at once:
And those are
actions, thoughts, feelings, and physiology.
the car metaphor he uses for this completely changed how I view my own habits.
It is so practical.
It really is. So think of your total behavior as a front-wheel drive car. The two front wheels are your actions and your thoughts.
Things you actively control.
Right. You have direct, conscious control over the steering wheel. You can choose to turn those front tires by changing what you do or what you actively think about.
And the back wheels.
The two back wheels are your feelings and your physiology, like your heart rate, your anxiety levels, or your sense of motivation.
And those back wheels do not have a steering mechanism.
Not at all. They're purely reactive. They simply follow wherever the front wheels drag them.
This illustrates perfectly where Bach management gets human psychology completely backwards. Bosses are obsessed with the back wheels.
Oh, totally. They constantly demand that their workers just feel more motivated, or they tell a highly anxious team to feel less stressed about an impending deadline.
Which makes no sense if you use the car analogy.
It's insane. Imagine driving down the highway and you decide you want to change lanes. But instead of turning the steering wheel, you lean out the window and try to manually twist the back tires with your bare hands.
It is absurd.
But that is exactly what we are doing when we look at a stressed-out coworker and say, "Just cheer up. Don't worry so much. You cannot mandate a feeling. You cannot manually twist the back wheels."
Lead managers understand that you must abandon the back wheels entirely and focus 100% of your energy on the front wheels.
So if an employee is feeling overwhelmed, a lead manager doesn't tell them to just feel better.
No, they help the employee change their actions, maybe by redesigning a broken workflow. Or they help them change their thoughts by reframing the priority of the tasks.
They know that if you steer the actions and thoughts in a better direction, the feelings of relief and the lowered physiological stress will naturally follow along.
Exactly. So practically speaking, how does a lead manager design the daily work environment so that workers proactively choose to steer their front wheels toward excellence?
All right, Pierce lays out three conditions for quality to make that happen.
Number 1, the environment must be respectful, warm, and built on absolute trust.
Okay, that makes sense. And number 2.
Number 2, workers must only be asked to do useful work.
Let's linger on that second condition for a moment. Useful work. Nothing destroys a worker's quality world faster than making them dig a hole just to fill it back in because management said so.
Oh, it's the worst. Pointless reporting, redundant meetings, or purely theatrical tasks frustrate the need for fun and power. People need to see that their labor actually moves the needle.
Well, which ties directly into the third condition, which is eliminating traditional inspectors. Lead managers do not stand over someone's shoulder with a red pen. Instead, they trust the worker's genius and ask them to evaluate their own work.
This shift is huge, and it is deeply rooted in how Pierce contrasts the 7 deadly behaviors with the 7 caring behaviors.
Okay, what are the deadly ones?
Bosses rely on blaming, threatening, complaining, nagging, punishing. These behaviors are designed to exert external control, and they instantly destroy trust.
And the caring ones.
Lead managers replace those with accepting, trusting, negotiating, listening, and encouraging.
So let's make that concrete. Instead of complaining that a project is behind schedule, which is a deadly behavior, a lead manager negotiates the timeline or listens to the obstacles blocking the team.
Exactly.
But this brings us to one of the most controversial stop you in your tracks points in the entire book. Pierce argues that a lead manager must operate under a total, strict ban on criticism.
A total ban.
I'm going to challenge this on behalf of every listener who manages people. No criticism at all. Not even so-called constructive criticism.
I know it sounds crazy.
Right. If someone is making huge mistakes, how are they supposed to improve if no one ever points out what they're doing wrong?
It sounds utterly counterintuitive to everything we are taught about feedback, but you have to look at the psychological trap of criticism through the lens of those 5 basic needs.
Okay, lay it out for me.
Remember the middle finger, the need for power, which includes self-respect, the precise moment a worker feels criticized. even if the manager delivers it politely in a feedback sandwich. And even if the criticism is 100% factually accurate, their deep psychological need for power is frustrated.
So it is registered by the brain as an attack on their identity.
Yes.
The bouncer at the VIP club goes on high alert.
Instantly. And what happens when an organism is attacked? It defends itself.
Oh, I see.
All of that employee's creative energy, which could have been used to creatively fix the flawed product, gets immediately redirected into ego preservation.
So they start defending themselves, making excuses, deflecting blame onto another department.
Or just resenting you. They are no longer trying to solve the problem. They are simply trying to restore their damaged self-respect.
Wow. So criticism, by its very biological nature, shuts down the exact higher-level creativity you need from them to fix the issue.
Exact.
The logic is airtight, but it leaves us with a massive practical void. If a lead manager is banned from criticizing, what is the protocol when an employee is actively failing?
Right, because you can't just ignore it.
No. Let's say someone is chronically late, or their code is full of bugs. We can't just smile, ignore it, and hope it goes away.
You never ignore poor performance, but your entire posture shifts. You step out of the role of a judge, and you step into the role of a coach.
Okay, and how do we actually do that?
To do this, Pierce introduces a highly structured, non-coercive problem-solving technique called a walk in the park.
The imagery he uses here is brilliant. I want you, the listener, to imagine a winding, M-shaped walking path through a quiet park. Along this path, there are 5 specific benches.
Right. And if you want to solve a performance issue without triggering defensiveness, you and the employee have to sit on these 5 benches in an exact sequence.
Let's walk the listener through them.
You start at bench number 1, the want bench. The leader simply asks, what do you want out of this situation?
Because before you can fix anything, you have to uncover what is actually inside this person's quality world right now.
Yeah.
Do they want more responsibility? Do they want less stress?
Exactly. Once you know their target, you walk together to bench 2, the doing bench.
Okay, what happens there?
The question here is, what exactly have you been doing to get what you want? This is purely a fact-finding mission. No judgment, no tone of disappointment, just listing the front wheel actions they have been taking.
Then you arrive at bench 3, which is the crux of the entire method, the self-evaluation bench.
The leader asks, has what you've been doing actually worked to get you what you want?
We really need to pause here, because this is the absolute genius of the system. By asking this question, you force the worker to look at their own actions and state out loud that their strategy isn't working.
Right, you aren't telling them they failed.
Exactly. Because they're the ones saying it, they keep their dignity completely intact. You aren't judging them. They are judging their own output against their own goals.
And that ego preservation we talked about earlier, it isn't triggered. Their defenses completely drop.
And once those defenses are down, the creative part of the brain re-engages.
Which means you can move to bench 4, the options bench.
Yeah.
You ask, what else could you do? Now you are brainstorming as partners.
And finally, you land at bench 5, the planning bench. You ask, are you ready to make a specific plan based on these new options?
Pierce gives a phenomenal real-world example of this in the text. There is a hospital director named Marie, and her assistant director, Jacqueline, is drowning.
Yeah, Jacqueline is completely overwhelmed, working late, and burning out.
Now, a traditional boss manager would look at this and immediately dispense criticism like, your time management is terrible, you need to delegate more, figure it out.
But Marie is a lead manager. She doesn't criticize. She takes Jacqueline for a walk in the park.
At the want bench, she asks Jacqueline what she actually wants. Jacqueline says she wants a sense of control and to actually enjoy her evenings again.
At the doing bench, Marie asks what actions she's been taking. Jacqueline lists all these complex scheduling tricks, admitting she tries to handle all the recruitment interviews herself because she doesn't want to look incompetent to the board.
Then Marie hits her with the magic question at the self-evaluation bench. Has hoarding all these interviews given you the balance and control you want?
And Jacqueline, looking at her own life, has to admit, no, it hasn't. It is actually creating the chaos she hates.
From there, the shift is incredible. Jacqueline herself realizes on the options bench that she needs to hand over the initial recruitment interviews to her own assistant, Shanti.
Marie didn't have to force her. She didn't have to issue a directive.
She simply guided Jacqueline to align her daily actions with her own internal quality world goals.
It is the perfect real-world example of steering the front wheels of the car. Marie helped Jacqueline change her thoughts and her actions, fully knowing that the back wheels, the feelings of being overwhelmed and stressed would naturally correct themselves as a result.
So when we zoom out and look at the big picture of everything Pierce is teaching, what does this actually mean for you listening right now?
Well, the core takeaway is that lead management is not just some niche corporate strategy for HR departments. It is a fundamental shift in how you view human agency.
It is about replacing the persistent illusion of external control with the undeniable reality of internal motivation.
It means respecting that every person you interact with operates on a hierarchy of being. They have a spirit, they have an identity, they have beliefs. They are not just a collection of behaviors for you to optimize.
It is about doing the hard, empathetic work of earning your way past the bouncer into their quality world.
And perhaps most importantly, it is about trusting them enough to evaluate their own work.
And we cannot stress enough that these principles scale to every relationship in your life.
Right. They apply to how you communicate with your spouse about household chores. They apply to coaching a little league team or guiding your teenagers through high school.
You truly cannot force anyone to do anything long term. You can only work to align the necessary tasks with what they internally value.
I want to leave you with a final thought, drawn directly from the closing ideas in Pierce's text. It ties right back to the question I asked you at the very beginning of this deep dive.
It's a great perspective shift.
Pierce notes a fascinating truth. The only thing in the physical world that continues to improve merely with the passage of time is an antique. Everything else degrades.
Exactly. Think about your own workplace. And think about that person you tried to force into compliance. Under traditional bossing, through the constant friction of coercion and criticism, relationships naturally degrade and break down over time.
They wear out.
But if you make the shift to lead management, if you ditch the criticism, if you focus on the front wheels, and if you invite people for a walk in the park, are you treating your team and your relationships like an antique?
That's the question.
Are you actively creating an environment where the quality, the trust, and the profound value of those connections actually compound and grow richer as the years go by?
It is a profound metric for evaluating not just our leadership, but how we choose to move through the world alongside others.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. See you next time.